So we're very lucky to have with us for our last panel this afternoon a very distinguished group of women who are going to be able to bring us back, I think, to the bigger picture. I should probably explain to our panelists that we started out this morning. We had a terrific presentation for Ambassador Goosby, who really took us through the evolution of some of PEPFAR's thinking on gender and integration, and also future directions and the ambitions that are out there for the next several years. And then we came back to look at some of the practicalities. We had terrific presentations from colleagues from Zambia and South Africa and Kenya about their experiences in actually trying to do this in real terms in the context of education programs and economic empowerment programs. But I like very much the note that Dr. Marston raised towards the end of his comments when he said, you know, we can't integrate everything with everything, so we have to make some strategic choices. And I think now at the end of this day of discussion, that's sort of what we want to get back to, is the policy level discussion, and to try to get a sense of where some of those strategic choices might lie and how people are thinking about them, both in the administration and in the Congress. So without further ado, I think what we're going to do is each of our panelists is going to speak for about 10 minutes, and then we'll, of course, open to Q&A. Rachel, I think we were going to start with you and then move to Amy and then to Anne and then to Pearl Alice, so in a rather logical sequence. So I think, Rachel, a quick introduction of you. Let me find my notes here. Rachel Vogelstein is the Senior Policy Advisor in the U.S. Secretary of State's Office of Global Women's Issues. In this capacity, she works on a variety of foreign policy issues related to the advancement of women and girls and focuses on global health and education. Prior to joining the State Department, Rachel served as an assistant counsel to then-Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton on her presidential campaign. She has also served as senior counsel at the National Women's Law Center, where she specialized in women's health and reproductive rights. So welcome, Rachel, and we're very anxious to hear more about what it really means to have a women and girls-centered approach.
Thank you. Well, I want to start by thanking Lisa for her kind introduction and for moderating today. And I'd also like to express my gratitude to Janet Fleischman and to CSIS for organizing this event and for your commitment to educating all of us on global health. And I want to thank my fellow panelists as well for their invaluable work in this area, much of which goes on in the wee hours of the morning, which I can personally attest to. I'll start by providing a little bit of background about the Secretary's Office of Global Women's Issues, where I work, and then I'll talk more about the women and girls-centered approach that we're implementing through the Global Health Initiative and discuss how it will be operationalized, and then turn to my colleagues for their expertise as they're really leading that effort. So first, more about the office. As many of you know, last year, President Obama announced the appointment of Milan Verveer as the first ever ambassador at large for global women's issues in order to ensure that issues related to women and girls would be integrated throughout U.S. foreign policy and State Department practices. And although our office focuses on women and girls, we believe that these issues should not be considered solely or uniquely of interest to women because, as the Secretary has noted time and again, if the potential of women and girls is fully developed and they participate in their societies on an equal footing with men, it's really the entire world that will benefit. And this is particularly true with respect to improving access to health care for women and girls. We know that improving the health of women also improves the health and lives of their families and their communities, and that the reverse is also true. But despite the importance of women's health to the well-being of families and communities, we know that progress in this area has remained far too slow. We're all familiar with the alarming trends indicating rapid growth in the number of women and girls living with HIV. The estimates, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where women constitute almost 60% of people living with HIV, and girls are 2 to 4.5 times more likely to become infected with HIV than boys. But we also know that there's a relationship between HIV/AIDS and other women's health issues, including maternal mortality and reproductive health. We know that HIV/AIDS is an important contributor to the high global rate of maternal mortality, and that Women who are infected with HIV are almost twice as likely to die in childbirth. We also know there's strong evidence that suggests that women infected by HIV have less access to family planning and to reproductive health services despite their higher vulnerability to mortality and morbidity. And we know that all of these health issues are exacerbated by societal conditions that affect women. For example, the scourge of gender-based violence that contributes both to maternal mortality and to the alarming rates of HIV infection. So these statistics, which you're all familiar with, highlight the interrelationship between HIV/AIDS, maternal mortality, and access to reproductive health care services. And they also suggest that addressing gender inequity is essential to improving the health of women and girls. So to that end, the Obama administration has developed the Global Health Initiative, which has a particular focus on improving the health of women, newborns, and children. And our office has had the great privilege of working with our colleagues at USAID and the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator at HHS and throughout the U.S. government to help develop the initiative. And we're really proud that of the core principles that guide the initiative, the very first is implementation of a women and girl-centered approach. All of the principles that guide the initiative, health system strengthening, integration, and the like, are crucial to efforts to improve women's health. But I want to talk in particular about this women and girl-centered approach and what it means. So the GHI team adopted a women and girl-centered approach for two reasons, because it's the right thing to do and because, as we know, it's the smart thing to do. We know that focusing on women and girls is the right thing to do because their unmet health needs are so significant, and that because of their reproductive role and patterns of gender discrimination, the world's women and girls really bear a disproportionate share of disease, violence, and mistreatment. And the statistics I cited earlier are certainly evidence of that. But we also know that focusing on women and girls is the smart thing to do because women the world over are primarily responsible for the care of their families. They're in charge of managing water, nutrition, and household resources, and they serve as conduits to health care for their families. So the ability of women to access health-related knowledge and services is really fundamental to not just their health, but the health of their babies, their older children, and their communities. And we also know that improving the health of women and girls enhances their productivity and social and economic participation and acts as a positive multiplier, which really benefits the development and health of future generations. So for both of those reasons, because it's the right thing to do and because it's the smart thing to do, the Global Health Initiative is pursuing this approach. And we're doing it in a few key ways. First, the initiative will strengthen support for programs that primarily serve women and girls, including maternal and child health programs, family planning, and nutrition programs. And the President's 2011 budget actually calls for significant increases in all of those areas, and the initiative itself sets ambitious new targets related to those areas. The initiative will also focus on building health systems and ensuring that women have access to an integrated package of essential services, which is so key. And then finally, the initiative will support long-term systemic changes to remove the economic, cultural, social, and legal barriers to healthcare services and really to increase the participation of women and girls in healthcare decision making. So it's really all three of these areas: scaling up high impact women's health interventions, developing and strengthening health systems, and ensuring integrated care, and addressing the social and behavioral determinants of health that are critical to saving lives and addressing the health of women and children. So what does this actually look like in practice? I'm just going to give a few key examples and then turn it over to my colleagues to fill in with more specifics. Certainly, as I said earlier, the initiative will scale up evidence-based, proven interventions that we know are crucial to the health of women and children, such as PMTCT, increased access to family planning services, and comprehensive maternal health services. But the initiative will also deploy the new model of business that's been alluded to earlier, based on core principles like integration, coordination, and system strengthening to better reach women and children. So, for example, to reduce the burden of seeking different health services in several different locations where possible, we will integrate, for example, family planning and maternal health services with our HIV/AIDS programs. We'll also work with partner countries to strengthen health systems in ways that specifically address the needs of women and children, such as by training healthcare providers, providing community-based care, ensuring a smooth supply chain for family planning drugs and devices and the like, and will address environmental and structural determinants that affect women's access to care by linking our health programs to other development efforts, such as, for example, education programs, given that the educational status of women is such an important predictor of women's health, or property, agriculture, and economic development programs to support women's self-sufficiency, and, of course, integration of gender-based violence, screening, and referrals into healthcare service delivery for women. We're also going to place an additional emphasis on a long-neglected area, adolescent girls, by linking to programs that address social determinants of their health status, including educational attainment, earlier forced marriage, and economic status. We'll promote women as leaders, as service providers, and as full partners in planning and implementation of health activities, and we'll seek to increase the number of female health service providers. We're also hoping to improve monitoring, evaluation, and research specifically on the health of women, adolescents, young girls, and, of course, to collect and disseminate sex disaggregated data. And importantly, we're committed to involving men and boys in advancing gender equity and improving health for women and girls, and, of course, partnering with civil society to address gender equity in healthcare more generally. So it's through this women and girls-centered approach that we're really hoping to make significant inroads in reducing the rates of HIV infection, unplanned pregnancy, maternal and child mortality, and improving the overall health of women and girls. So how will this approach be implemented? That's a great question, and our office is really committed to ensuring that the principle of a women and girl-centered approach really translates into real changes on the ground and results in tangible improvements for women's health. And to that end, our office is going to be convening an interagency task force to help concretize and operationalize that approach. And so the task force will do a few things. It will help coordinate guidance to the field. We'll also develop best practices on programming related to women and girls. Will serve as a resource to the Global Health Initiative implementing in-country teams as needed, and will also monitor progress specifically on implementing a women and girls-centered approach. So we'll welcome your input and thoughts on all of that as we move forward.
So I need to say a word of introduction, please. So, Rachel, thank you. That was great. Next, we'll turn to Amy Batson, who joined USAID recently as the Deputy Assistant Administrator for Global Health and the USAID Deputy for the Global Health Initiative. She's had a 20-year career in global health, which has included positions in the WHO, UNICEF, and most recently with the bank, where she helped lead the bank's efforts on vaccine financing. So welcome, Amy. We look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you very much for having me here today. We consider this to be an extremely important topic. Secretary Clinton, Administrator Shaw, all my colleagues at USAID, at OGAC, and all of the other partners in the GHI recognize the importance of implementing more of a woman and girl-centered approach, as gender is integral both to achieving our development goals as well as our health-specific one. What I wanted to do today to complement my other colleagues here was give you a little bit more of a sense of the kinds of investments that USAID is making to promote gender equality. Some of the learning that's been going on, which will then be ramped up, taken forward in other places as appropriate through the GHI. And the way we look at it is implementing a woman and girl-centered approach, one needs to address both the systems which provide women with the health care, as well as the determinants, the social and the economic, which determine whether they can access that care. And then continually be looking at that balance between sort of what we can, what we're providing and the quality of that provision with the actual ability of the women to make use of it. We are approaching the issue in a number of ways. One is a recognition that addressing gender is multi-sectoral. It's not just a health problem. We really need to be thinking creatively across different spheres. One is that we are now requiring within USAID that gender be integrated into the design, the implementation, the monitoring of all of its different health projects, of all of its different projects and programs, whether it be our economic growth, education, governance, or health. So a much broader spread on the gender front and how we're looking to approach it within the agency. also looking, we have already been developing an expertise of our staff in the Global Health Bureau, in a Women in Development office, and in other other parts of the Bureau on gender. And that group is meeting regularly to share ideas across their different forms of expertise, and we'll be engaging closely with the task force that that Rachel was just laying out for you. What we've been working on to date is really looking for innovative ways to meet the special needs of women and girls, and looking at that in the forms of the different components we're working in health, family planning, reproductive health, maternal health, child health, nutrition, infectious diseases, HIV, AIDS, et cetera. But a few of the issues of looking at where a woman's ability to access appropriate care is restricted, we know that the services can be provided through other means, for example, through trained community outreach workers. And so we're working in a number of countries to be training female community volunteers so that they can be bringing actual treatment for anemia, education on nutrition, information and access to contraceptive methods for healthy timing and spacing of pregnancies, et cetera. I'm also looking to make commodities such as condoms, contraceptive pills, other medications much more easily accessible through not only traditional means like pharmacies, but also kiosks and even beauty salons. A women-centered approach also requires that the health programs look at the broader societal environment that influences a woman's behavior. So USAID has been investing in creative community mobilization efforts that involve peers, neighbors, teachers, religious leaders, and other influential stakeholders to help improve the health of the women and address some harmful practices that may be going on within different communities or cultures. So, for example, in India, we have programs that are supporting community theater, painting of murals with messages about the importance of delaying marriage and first pregnancy. And these are complementing community educational sessions for adolescents, newlyweds, and mother-in-laws. Another program we have in Ethiopia, where USAID is working with school teachers, youth, and community elders to change the attitudes and practices around child marriage. And they've set up girls advisory committees in more than 3,700 public schools to encourage that both married and unmarried girls attend schools and to help limit the child marriage or the pressures on child marriage. USAID is looking to tackle some of the gender inequalities through looking at the various building blocks of the health system. And this is done by helping the countries review and analyze different aspects of their program, their human resources for health, and in countries where having a female health worker is an essential component to ensuring the provision and the access of health services, looking at those different kinds of aspects, or looking at just even collecting the data all told. So in Rwanda, been supporting an assessment of workplace violence and sexual harassment so that the kind of results and the data starts to inform national policy, A, creating the awareness of the problem, and then B, how and where best to address it. USAID is also engaging in training the health personnel in many country settings to ensure that they have the kind of state-of-the-art healthcare practices, such as training of providers on fistula repair. A second sort of key place where we're looking is where the various health programs cannot really meet the needs of women and girls if we're not also looking at gender-based violence. And this is often, I'm sure has been discussed this morning, one of the hidden or less addressed problems in many countries. So USAID is working with various community groups to mobilize efforts on promoting prevention of gender-based violence by increasing the awareness, not only the individual but the community, about the violence and promoting some self-reflection about the norms that perpetuate violence and are facilitated by different environments. In particular, we've been working with religious leaders who are often the most trusted and respected members of the community and are therefore often the key catalyst for change, for social change. And so in Africa, we've been working to build the capacity of religious leaders and faith-based organizations to reduce gender-based violence and HIV among women and girls. In Yemen and Egypt, this has taken the form of working with religious leaders to promote messages about the negative health effects of early marriage and too early childbearing. Of course, men and boys are an extremely important component to women's empowerment and gender equality, and so also looking at new ways to better involve men and boys in supporting the health of women and their families, along with, of course, the men and boys' own well-being. So USAID has been supporting some innovative and very formative research in this area, and will continue to expand this work in GHI. It's also been working to train providers to improve couples' communications and looking toward joint decision-making related to family size, childbearing, and the use of contraception. So really working within the community and with the health workers themselves about how they can be messaging some of these key issues and engaging the two partners in the process. Clearly, effective health program has to look at non-health-related obstacles that may be limiting access to knowledge and services and therefore decreasing the productivity. So looking at many of the longer-term systemic changes to removing barriers and increasing the access to quality health services, that can range anything from just the hours that a clinic is open, the days that a clinic is open, to the financial incentives for families, to different types of legal rights, educational opportunities, and economic empowerment. And so taking this kind of broader range of issues to look at beyond just the medical intervention itself can sometimes have the biggest impact in ensuring the access. Also looking, as was mentioned, this issue of logical linkages among the health services to increase the efficiency and the convenience of services for women. Some of the particular linkages that we think are really bear more attention is within, for example, nutrition and linking kind of the social protection work that's going on with agricultural sectors to ensure a woman's empowerment and her access to various assets like agricultural technologies so that we're paving the way for her to have an income generation. Looking at different models for more integrated family planning and fistula care. And in fact, in Africa, we have eight sites that are linking these two areas, improving the provider's knowledge and also providing then more skills in contraceptive technology, counseling, and access to contraceptive methods as well. To meet the specific needs of very young mothers and young women for contraception, USAID is also supporting integrated, youth-friendly postpartum family planning services and putting them into existing family planning services in a country like Haiti. And so there's providing training on youth-friendly services that improve provider attitudes and community and address community biases and ensure that you are really focusing on increasing a young woman's access to family planning services. A key issue in improving the whole area of women and girls-centered approach is making sure that we actually have the metrics and the data to learn what is the impact of the various strategies that are being used, where is there major gaps in the programs. And so we've had a big increase in this focus in this area, but see this as a major component of GHI going forward, given GHI's very, very strong commitment to transparency and providing more of an evidence base for all decision making. And so looking at how we can inform policy by more accurate data that is really showing what is the situation of women and girls on the ground. A number of different ways that we'll all be going at this. One is through the USAID Demographic and Health Surveys, the DHS. And very specifically, the DHS is providing data now on gender inequality, women's empowerment, gender norms, domestic violence, and female genital mutilation and cutting. And so as a result, we have some comparable information on the prevalence of domestic violence against women, for example, in over 25 countries. And that's providing an enormously valuable base of information to impact policy, advocacy, and programmatic interventions. We're also looking at, been developing and testing a framework for gender integration in programs, as well as some specific recommendations for integration of efforts to address gender-based violence in population health and nutrition programs, and have been collaborating with a number of multilaterals, WHO, UNIFEM, UNFPA, UNAIDS, and various other bilateral and country partners on developing a shared gender and health monitoring and evaluation framework that includes indicators on gender equality, empowerment, and health. As we've learned in a number of other sectors, the value of having a few really strong indicators, and perhaps most importantly, having indicators that we're all sharing rather than each of us coming up with slightly different versions of the same indicator and then overburdening the system with requiring sort of the same data be collected but in slightly different ways, has proven to be extremely important. And so learning from that experience of what to do and what not to do, we're starting early here in really trying to get sort of more commonality in how we approach indicators. One big challenge that we're still facing is on implementing a woman-girl-centered approach is increasing the sophistication in measuring gender equity and women's empowerment outcomes, in addition to impact on health. So we're supporting the development of reliable scales to better measure changes in gender norms. And we've been collaborating with a number of donors to develop a data model that illustrates the relationship between women's empowerment and health outcomes that might be used for helping improve policy formulation. And finally, I would say USAID is now working closely with a number of multilaterals and donors to include joint documentation on best practices in gender and in health, to be able to put forward some of the best models that we've each discovered and ensure that they can be shared with a number of countries and then, if deemed appropriate, replicated. And the task force that Rachel has mentioned, I think, will be in a very important piece of our really collecting all of this information in one place and making it as widely accessible as possible. So we're very much looking forward to working on that. Thank you.
Amy, thanks very much. And particularly, I think the point you made on data and metrics, I wouldn't be surprised if you got some questions from this group on that. It's been a subject of discussion sort of throughout the day and also at a discussion some of us had last night. Next, it's my pleasure to introduce Anne Gavigan, who's the Chief of Staff in the Office of the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator. Prior to joining the State Department, Anne served as a legislative assistant in the Office of Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, where she worked on both domestic and international issues. Anne is also a trained HIV counselor and has worked with nonprofits and community-based HIV programs in Brooklyn, South Africa, and Taiwan. Thanks for joining us, Anne.
Thanks very much, Lisa. I'd also like to thank Janet and everybody at CSIS. I'd like to thank the other panelists with me today. I spend a lot of time on the phone with Rachel and Amy. We talk to each other daily because this administration takes a woman and girl-centered approach very seriously, to the point where we are really trying to figure it out and operationalize it in a way that takes up hours and hours of conference calls. So, because it is so important. And I really do want to thank the efforts of actually all of you out in the audience, because you're the folks on the front lines who are really putting this forward and really trying to raise these issues and really emphasizing the importance of gender as we are looking at both our health and development programs. There have been a lot of questions about PEPFAR's role in the Global Health Initiative. Ambassador Goosby probably answered a lot of them this morning, so I'm going to make my presentation very brief so as it not to be redundant. But I do want to note that at PEPFAR and at the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator, we're extremely excited to be part of the GHI, and we're extremely excited about the notion of the GHI, because AIDS is a women's health issue. When we're looking at the leading cause of death for women of reproductive age worldwide, it's HIV/AIDS. And we really need to be focusing on the ways — Rachel ran through a lot of the statistics earlier today about the way that AIDS is seen or is not seen as a women's health issue. One of the things that has been a real innovation of the community around HIV is focusing on the term person living with HIV. And I think one of the challenges we faced in PEPFAR is that when we started our programs, we were very much focused on the HIV part of that. And what we need to be doing now is really moving back and saying, let's look at that person living with HIV and let's focus on their needs as a person, their health and development needs. If you have a woman living with HIV, HIV could be the sixth or seventh or eighth thing on the list of her priorities. She's going to be focused on how she feeds her kids and her family. She could be focused on the malaria that her kids have. She could be focused on the needs for family planning. If she's not feeling sick that day, AIDS may not be the thing on her mind. So if we're going to be doing her a service and making sure that she gets the HIV AIDS services that she needs, what we need to do is figure out ways to package that and put that in with the other services that are required for just her general way of life. And we need to do this not only on an individual-by-individual basis, but on a community-wide and then nationwide level so that there is support for this at all levels of the health system. PEPFAR has been doing this to date through what we term wraparound programming, where we've really tried to leverage our investments or link our investments to initiatives where we can provide the HIV services and then package that as part of an overall package of services for primary and secondary health care needs. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but I know you got a bunch of that from Ambassador Goosby this morning. But I think we face some real challenges in doing this, which is why we really welcome the GHI. It's an emphasis from this administration across all the health programs to make that smart integration and coordination a priority and to say, how can we focus on this not only from the perspective of PEPFAR, but from the perspective of some of the other health and development programs so that you have everybody thinking from that same mindset and working on the ground from a health perspective, but also from a diplomatic perspective at the embassy level to really say, how can our program support this woman and girl-centered approach? We've got some issues around this as we're thinking about the investments we've made so far. We have done a very poor job about linking our achievements in MDG 6 to the achievements of the other health-related Millennium Development Goals, and this is something we need to get better about. As we're looking at MDG 4 and 5, as we're looking at increased and correct investment around MCH, what we need to do is say, here's how the activities we've carried out in MDG 6 so far around AIDS, TB, and malaria have really helped to establish the health systems necessary to allow women and children to get the services they need. And that's something I would put out as a challenge to you, if we could all help to think together around how our investments over the past 10 years through PEPFAR, through the Global Fund, through UNAIDS, through other organizations around HIV/AIDS have really helped to build those systems. I think that that's something we'd really like to start working on documenting more. I know that there's been some initial focus on that. But again, stressing the interconnected nature of it, it's not as if we could take away one and expect to have success in the others. And we really need to be emphasizing that. In order for us to build systems through our investments in MDG 6, we need to look at the investments we have there and the platforms that we've already been built up. And the question now is how we can use those platforms like PEPFAR at that health clinic PEPFAR may be supporting, may have renovated. How do we use additional PEPFAR investments or bring in other investments to make sure that we're hiring a doctor to deal with family planning and delivery of babies? It's something where PEPFAR can provide the seed investments, can provide a lot of the mechanisms through which we run the day-to-day environments at the clinic, and with small additional investments, leverage what we've already put in place to really then make sure that we're addressing health needs. The health worker that we train with PEPFAR money is not just going to be treating AIDS. And I think it's time that we make sure that we're pushing that and talking about all of the things that we can and have done with PEPFAR money and the additional things we can do to make sure that we are achieving this woman and girl-centered focus. We do need to do a better job in regards to integration and coordination. This is something that I think the Global Health Initiative will let us do. And I think we've seen some examples of where it's worked well in PEPFAR countries with programs like the GAIN project in Nigeria, where we've got a program where funding hospitals where you can receive comprehensive quality health care services, where this is tied into income support and income generation programs for HIV-positive women. So it's addressing not only their health needs for HIV, it's addressing their health needs for family planning, for reproductive health, and it's addressing some of the larger structural issues that Rachel and Amy talked about before. I know Ambassador Goosby went into some of the new things that PEPFAR is doing this morning, so I don't want to be redundant on those, but I do want to just stress that as part of the Global Health Initiative, we're really looking at our gender investments. During the first five years of PEPFAR, there were some pretty innovative things going on in terms of gender, in terms of disaggregation of data, in terms of figuring out how our services were impacting women. And we had several programs with our gender strategy that did move forward to address involvement of men and boys and making sure that we were addressing the needs of young girls around HIV/AIDS education with things like the You Go Girl initiative. What we're trying to do now is focus on several other things, really making sure, first of all, that we're addressing the hidden epidemic of gender-based violence. We're starting programs in three countries, and we're looking to expand this in other countries, where we're really looking at the fact that women who experience sexual and gender-based violence are at increased risk for HIV/AIDS, and making sure that they have the services and the support that they need in order to prevent new HIV infections, but also help them get out of those situations of violence, helping to train the larger mechanisms that deal with and address gender-based violence so that we're training the policemen, we're training the law enforcement officials in a way that allows them to recognize the gender-based violence and its health and development impacts. We're also establishing a gender challenge fund because one of the things that's been a barrier to doing all of this in the field is people haven't had to really, when we're talking to people about integrating gender into everything you do, that's a very good thing to say. But when we actually try to operationalize it, that's where we kind of run into some barriers. Even if we are focusing around five topics like gender, the gender strategy of PEPFAR. So with this Gender Challenge Fund, one thing we'll be able to do is coalesce some of our gender activities around specific projects, in addition to trying to integrate it into everything we do, but really have specific projects that help to jumpstart and accelerate several of our gender initiatives in countries, working with our country teams who know what's going on in the ground to address something that's going to be responsive to what's happening there, and then having them put some of their country budgets into that to really help to make sure that they're committed to this as well. So we're excited about those possibilities and about learning what we can in terms of best practices that might be able to be expanded across all of these health programs. But I do want to stress that PEPFAR is really excited about the Global Health Initiative because it is a way in which we can move forward with integration and coordination. It's a way in which we can serve the needs of the majority of the people we're trying to serve who happen to be women and girls. And it's a way we can really make an impact and improve HIV outcomes in addition to the overall health outcomes that are faced by the populations in need. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Anne. And let me give a quick introduction to our final panelist, Dr. Pearl Alice Marsh, who currently serves as the majority professional staff member for the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. She's responsible to the chairman for oversight of foreign assistance and legislation related to Africa and global health. Prior to serving with the committee, Dr. Marsh was the executive director of the Africa Policy Information Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and thank all of you for the tenacity to stick around this late in an all-day conference. And thank you, Janet and CSIS and my fellow panelists and those who were on earlier for this great conference that you're having today. Well, I work, as we said, for Congressman Howard Berman, who has taken up the daunting task of rewriting the Foreign Assistance Act that hasn't been rewritten since 1961 or 63. Which in all of those years has become quite a horrible beast, one that has encumbered our agencies and all of the young, bright talent that we have in their attempt to deliver the kind of programs that we have authorized. So we're in the process of writing the whole act, but a significant piece of that will be the global health portion, which will include very strong focus on women and girls. Addressing the needs of women and girls is assumed. You have to excuse me, I left my glasses at work, so I'll have to stumble through here. But addressing the needs of women and girls has assumed a major priority with the intent to promote and improve the status of women and girls, guarantee their ability to access and utilize health services without fear, gender-based violence, reprisal, discrimination, or other mistreatment. and specifically promote the ability of women and girls to access reproductive health services, family planning, life skills, and livelihood programs. Now, that's the purpose of trying to focus on how do we integrate all of these initiatives and programs and legislation that we have talked about and make it functional. In order to do that, our legislation is relying on several things. One is it's intended to provide more flexibility for the administration. As I said, if you look at the law, I've forgotten how many thousands of carbuncles there are on it that are restrictions and requirements and reports and everything else you can possibly imagine that, in fact, has harmed the delivery of our program. When we pass our legislation and it gets over to the administration, I don't think there's much left for you to do except try and sort through and sift through everyone's pet projects and pet peeves to try and come up with some kind of implementation. The second thing we're trying to do is provide greater accountability to Congress. We can't provide flexibility without greater accountability. And that includes making sure that we have measurable indicators of success that Congress can look to and quite easily say, yes, the funds that we're appropriating, authorizing and appropriating, are doing what they're intended to do. The second is to have very powerful monitoring and evaluation systems, again, so that we have data and evidence that that the programs that we're supporting are moving us in the right direction to attain the goals that we intend. Next is to establish needs-based and performance-based system for allocating development resources. I have for years demanded that our Congressional Research Service do a very detailed analysis of how our funds are being spent. And then I come and I make the strong argument that the funds aren't being appropriated in a rational kind of way. And I make that case with all my members on our subcommittee and with the members on our committee. And then, don't quote me, but we get back to the appropriations process and it's, well, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, you know, security. It goes all the way back there. And in spite of all of our heavy-laden rhetoric, development assistance outside of those major states and countries that are directly linked to what we define as our security, it gets quite anemic. So we want to establish a more rational basis for allocating those resources. And last, we want to institutionalize strategic planning and review process so that we're constantly using planning and review as a way to build on success, build on lessons learned, and then learn from things that have failed so that we improve the process. In order to do that, we want these programs to be consistent with three principles. One is country ownership. And I'm only repeating something where there's a kind of a consensus building from everywhere that the countries themselves have to begin determining or telling us, or we have to start listening to what the countries say they want and they need. We've been very good at telling them what they need, but they not telling them or letting them express theirs. The second, obviously, is capacity building. We're always needing to do capacity building on ourselves, so there's no insult to tell professionals who are on the front lines in Africa that, you know, we can work with them to build their capacities and strengthen their systems so that they deliver on the promises and the dreams that they want. And then the last is really effective partnerships. And by effective partnerships, someone dusted off my brain the other day and reminded me of the days when we were enamored with Paulo Freire. I don't know if you still are, but he did have that idea that every teacher is a student and every student is a teacher. And I say that that's the same quid pro quo with us and our development partners, that we learn from them and we teach, and it's vice versa. They learn from us and they teach. And I have a little demonstration or a little illustration of learning from this just happened this afternoon. I had a briefing on the Hill with a Kenyan woman who runs a special project there. And I tell you, I have to say, I think Kenyan women are probably the smartest in the world, certainly among the smartest. And they have been doing, through their AIDS program, education for adolescent girls. And then they thought, well, if we're doing education, one of the reasons that you know, we deal with adolescent teen pregnancies because girls have no money. So they were doing the life skills training for them, and then they thought maybe we should help them learn how to develop their entrepreneurial skills, and they did that. And 80% of the girls, you know, they were able to place in a job. So 20% they weren't. And so they took the 20% and said, look, why don't you think of something really innovative that you can do? And this is what these girls came up with. It's a washable sanitary napkin. And it's sort of, you know, and the reason they did this is they presented the center with a problem that girls use straw, they use leaves, they even use cow manure. They miss school. That 4 or 5 days out of the month is totally disruptive. So they came and they designed this. There are 4 girls that now make 50 a day, and they sell them throughout the markets in their town in nice little cardboard packages. And you know what? The teachers have now begun to notice that girls aren't missing school. And if you think about how a simple little imaginative innovation that didn't come, you know, from us here in Washington and didn't even come from the head there in Nairobi, it came from the girls, but that someone was smart enough to invest in it, and now it's not only having an effect on just the quality of those girls' lives, but on their education and on empowering them to function. So the idea of partnering and letting the students teach us as we teach them, I think, is very important. Now, as authorizers, I wish we were appropriated too, but we don't. But as authorizers, I will just say, and winding up my speech quite seriously, that we have 2 major issues, aside from authorizing and defining through legislation what we think some of the direction of linkages for all the programming that you all know and are much smarter at than I. But 2 of them have to do with maintaining the funding levels for and the environment for the programs that we're talking about with health. And we know that right now there's increased competition among all of our programs. There's also the economic crisis that doesn't seem to be going away. And the second is that global women's health really has been used as a proxy for anti-abortion battles in our country and has had a terrible impact on the provision of family health and reproductive health services in Africa. On the first point about funding, it's very important that advocates keep the pressure on Congress, or certainly keep reminding Congress that we have made commitments. We've made long-term commitments through PEPFAR and through the Global Health Initiative to fund health programs for women and girls in poor countries. But we also have to start working with African countries, not just tell them they have to begin making more contributions, but helping them to get better handle on their own budgeting systems so that they can make better contributions. And this is something that I've been quoting, and this is, I think, my 3rd or 4th presentation this week. The Global Financial Institute did a study, and they found that between 1970 and 2009, an estimated $854 billion illicit financial outflows from Africa occurred. That's $854 billion that was generated in Africa, left the continent. Between 1970 and 1979, that figure was $57 billion. But between 2000 and 2008, it increased to $437 billion just in that decade alone. Now, what that last figure indicates that we know is that, in fact, most African economies are growing. They're growing at paces of 5, 7, 8%, which is quite good. But they don't have the financial governance systems in place where they can control what happens to that money and then use that money for social investment and for economic investment in their own countries. So it's extraordinarily important that we, as a donor community, assist them in developing financial governance systems so as we put our funds into our programming, they really do have a legitimate way to assess what their capacities are and to put their funding into our program as well. I was kind of alarmed, which is what pushed me in this direction more aggressively recently, when I saw that finance ministers in Africa had met recently and really pushed back and said that their heads of states are going abroad to all of these conferences and their heads of states have to, you know, let us know that they're good partners and allies and they're doing what's best for their people. And so they're making commitments that they really do not have the discipline within their economies or with their financial governance systems to deliver on. So this is a critical element of our development assistance programs that we will have to include over, you know, the course of the reauthorization of this program. And then the last thing I want to discuss then, I did want to give you an illustration there. I met just recently with the advisor from the Treasury Department Office of Technical Assistance who's been out in Zambia. And she's been there working with the finance minister, and they uncovered 1,500 separate checking accounts with authorizations and authority to write checks everywhere, down to, you know, small projects out in villages. And the finance minister had absolutely no way of retrieving any information on how that money was being spent. So the advisor has been working with the finance minister to get control over how that cash had expended, cut out all of those 1,500 checking accounts, consolidate into three or four accounts in two or three banks so that they know exactly what's happening with their funds. Africa's poor. I'm not trying to get us off the hook that we can, you know, make our commitments and then push it off on Africa in a couple of years. But Africa does have resources. African leaders, and particularly the new generation of leaders, now in their 30s and 40s, really are committed to taking up their responsibility as governments, and we can help them do that. Now, on the issue of integrating health services for women, particularly family planning and reproductive health, I'm only quoting you figures that you already know. That in most African countries, it's the maternal mortality rates are as horrific as 1 out of 14 women dying. I've seen figures as awful as 1 in 8. Whereas if you look at developed countries like ours, it's what, 1 in 4,000, 3,000? Opposition to family planning and reproductive health services in poor countries is a form of femicide. What we're doing is deliberately letting ideology and politics get in the way of women's lives, and we can't do that. So what we have to do as Congress that write the law, and we need support from all of you, those who consider themselves pro-choice, those who consider themselves right to life, to stop this femicide. We're not talking about one woman in 2,000 in the developing world and then one woman in 4,000 in the developed world. We're talking about one woman in 14. Look around this room and count off every 14, you know, little cohorts of women and think about in each one of these tables that one woman would die today. It's unacceptable. So those two things are going to be central, and I think are central, to all of the things we want to do and all of you know how to do around linking services and integrating services is really make sure that the funding is there and make sure that we really do focus on the healthcare needs of women and stop focusing on our ideological and political needs. Thank you.
Perlaus, thanks very much. And I think what we'll do now is open the floor to questions. We'll take the questions probably in groups of three, and I ask that you identify yourself, please, as you pose your question. I'm actually going to take the liberty, while people are getting their questions, in order of posing the first one. You know, what I've heard here this morning is, or this afternoon, rather, is a very clear and unified and strong commitment to these principles, you know, but a number of you have mentioned the real challenges of operationalizing them. I mean, one of them being the big challenge of we're committed to the principle of country ownership, but if a country doesn't necessarily view integration in the same way that we do, what do we do then? You know, and it strikes me that to actually drive this agenda forward effectively, we're going to have to do business in a different way, both in terms of how the U.S. government works internally in Washington, how missions work internally overseas, how budgeting is done, how program planning is done, even issues as fundamental as how USAID works with particular sets of contractors in particular sectors and how we get them to work better together. So I'm wondering if anyone would like to address some of those challenges, the operationalization challenges. And in particular, I know we don't have the list of GHI focus countries yet, but I'm imagining that those countries are in some ways going to provide a bit of a lab for doing some of this differently. And I'm if anyone could provide some speculation even on how that might work, I think that would be appreciated. I know one of our other participants here a while ago raised the issue of the partnership frameworks and, you know, how are they being used to advance the gender agenda. And I guess my question is, are we even thinking about expanding the content of those partnership frameworks a bit beyond just the PEPFAR agenda, but to include some of the broader issues within GHI. So if any of you would be interested in answering that, I'd be very grateful.
Everybody looks at me when they say partnership frameworks, so I'm going to start with some of that. But I do want to note that I'm really glad Perales brought up the issue of accountability. And when she's talking about the finance ministers, there are targets to spend 15% of budgets on health care. And the example that you were referring to is part of concern from some governments about this 15% target. And finance ministers are saying, why should we be beholden to this thing that was a high-level commitment pushed by our health ministers? Part of the problem is that health ministers are usually not as powerful as finance ministers. So one of the questions I have is, how are we engaging with finance ministers? How are we working with them in order to make sure that these issues rise to this? This high-level political commitment, getting a president is great, but administrations change. Getting a finance minister who knows how to move the money, they're usually more technocratic, or working with a bunch of technocratic people. Getting into that sphere and working with the civil service there to demonstrate how this is a priority and the economic impact, as people have discussed here today, of supporting a gender-based approach to health is really important. The partnership frameworks are one mechanism for doing this, for engaging with governments around this. Partnership frameworks are a five-year agreement that's focused around HIV/AIDS issues, where we say, as we're looking at HIV/AIDS, how can we make sure that the U.S. government is making these commitments for the next 5 years. Here's what we're going to do to address HIV/AIDS issues. The partner government is making certain commitments, and then some other partners are often included in this as well. Gender is coming into some of these. Some of it's coming in through PMTCT or specific activities. We are trying to address some of the structural pieces in there. But I think one of the things that we should be looking at partnership frameworks as a tool to do is start engaging with the government. Because, again, the first 5 years of PEPFAR were rightfully so focused on the emergency needs of saving lives and getting over that crisis. And now that we're engaging in the discussions with governments that we need to engage in to get that long-term sustainability and really develop partnerships between the U.S. government and other countries, the partnership framework is not we do it and then we walk away. It's that start of the dialogue. And as we work on starting that dialogue, we're continuing to provide our services through many of the international NGOs and local CSOs and faith-based organizations, but we're also thinking about how the government can then be put in the position of doing that. The very first partnership framework we signed was signed with the Minister of Finance in Malawi, and I think that we're trying to really focus on ways, new and innovative ways to engage governments. Partnership frameworks represent a first step in that, but it's a step, and it has to be an ongoing commitment.
If I could add to what Anne said, I think one thing we've often seen is that some of the most powerful learning for a country doesn't come from us. It comes from another country. And so creating sort of the forum, well, identifying the really innovative things that are going on in country, and then creating a forum where countries can be sharing with each other, where one government can share with another or NGOs can share, why they started these programs, how they worked, what were the challenges they faced, and what were the impact of it, can often be some of the most influential sort of forms of learning that can happen. And so I think one of our big commitments with GHI is to really be trying to, when we talk about innovation, it's less us sitting here innovating, and it's more let's find the innovations that are going on right now in every country, in districts, that often even the country isn't aware is going on. It's often one little district, and nobody's aware of it. And trying to start really cataloging, capturing these things, sharing them more broadly, and then creating the space for the countries and for the country partners to be talking with each other much more and be talking with us as well and educating us all. And there may be ways that we can take some of these lessons, write them up, share them in different ways, create some tools that help embody them and provide those. So I think that'll be one important way of really moving forward in the country. I think other areas is in you were noting that agencies like USAID will need to fundamentally change the way it does business as well, and I think that that's true. One of the biggest, probably the biggest reform going on right now in USAID is about procurement, and there is a massive procurement reform going on to see how to change the way USAID does procurement so that more money can be flowing to smaller bodies, local partners. To be supporting some different areas of work, some different partners who can really have an enormous impact, but who to date have been sort of too small or not met the financial requirements or whatever it may have been that they weren't eligible to receive some of the grants given the size that they were. And so this reform is going to be it's been going on since the administrator started in December and will be launched at the end of, I believe, in July. And is a very, very serious reform, and it is number one on the administrator's agenda. So there will be some very real changes in how we do business, along with the sort of programmatic changes that we are seeing as a result of GHI and the sort of focus on how do we better align our programs with the government and the other national partners' programs. I just say the one third area that I think will be quite important in terms of really moving forward on this is collaboration. This isn't the USG alone. This is really a question about how do we work better with all different types of partners, so the various multilateral and bilateral partners who are operating and supporting different countries, with the NGOs, the FBOs, the CSOs, to really be jointly working together on and helping to support change in country and helping to build capacity to take forward some of the new areas of work that make sense in different countries' environments. And so I think that, again, what GHI really brings is a much greater attention as well as much more space and support at all levels to be supporting that kind of collaboration, coordination with others. And I think through that mechanism, we also have a much, much better chance to really be changing how we do work, but also changing and increasing the level of impact that we can have.
Take some questions from the floor here, please.
Thank you very much. This has been a great session. I'd like to follow up on Dr. Marsha's comment about Kenyan women with a very small little vignette, and that is that 6 years ago when I was working in East Africa, and I've just come back from working on a regional program there, we started talking to women about why they were at risk for HIV. And what they didn't say to us is, well, we don't know about AIDS, or, oh, we don't know how to reduce partners, or we don't know how. What they said is, I have three kids to feed, and I don't have a job. And so I'm having sex with truck drivers, and I'm having sex with truck drivers without a condom because I can make more money, and that's what I need to do. So we started doing programming to find jobs that would pay a living wage to those women so that they could actually act on the risk behaviors and ask and act on the knowledge that they already had. So I'm listening today about all of the focus on monitoring and evaluation and indicators and accountability, and I'm contrasting that with equal emphasis on innovation and on country-led solutions. And I'm, you know, asking us to and asking you what your thoughts are about, as we start to look at accountability, we have to think about PEPFAR that said, as we were doing all that economic strengthening and providing jobs for these women, and we were thinking, Is that ABC? Is that prevention messages? Is that, you know, because the indicators were so constraining. And the indicators were constraining because, frankly, Congress needed to know how many people we were reaching with AB messages and how many condoms we were distributing. So I'm asking us to all think, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about this, about how we, as we start to look at accountability and as we start looking at indicators and measuring our success, that we can make sure that we allow the innovation that allows a country-driven response, that allows an even local response below country-driven, by focusing on ultimate results and the outcomes and not focusing on approved strategies. And I think that's a difficult thing to do, but I would love to get the thoughts of the women on this panel about how we focus on results and not on approved strategies. Thanks.
Thanks. Other questions? Sorry, over here.
Hi, I'm Rose Wilcher from FHI. And Anne, I think this comment is for you. A lot of your comments echoed what Ambassador Goosby said this morning in terms of PEPFAR's commitment to leveraging its existing medical platform to provide other broader services that better address the health needs of women in general. And in fact, I think you said that, you know, a medical provider trained by PEPFAR will be doing more than just providing HIV/AIDS care and support to women. But what I'm still a little unclear on, because I think this is all very encouraging and I'm very excited about it, but what I'm a little unclear on is how, under the GHI, this will actually be operationalized and financed. And so I guess I have a pretty specific question, which is, if, for example, PEPFAR is committed to ensuring that family planning services are available to women in HIV care and treatment centers so that her unmet reproductive health needs can be met, will PEPFAR dollars actually be used to provide that family planning support? Or does that somehow still remain the domain of population funding? I'm just a little unclear on that. Thanks.
Do we have another question? Or so why don't we go with those two, and then we'll come back for... So the first question, any responses? About how to make sure we focus on measuring outcomes and not necessarily strategies.
Well, I think you need a strategy. I mean, you can't have outcomes if you don't kind of lay a strategy for where you want to go. But I think what we need is for the strategy and the planning to not be so restrictive in determining narrowly what a program should do, that we define a way, you know, the kind of outcomes that could be useful and helpful in us understanding whether we were actually having an impact. So I leave it to, you know, the people at PEPFAR and USAID and GHI to figure out technically how you do that. But outcomes are very important. You also talked about innovation and how do we make sure that innovation somehow get mainstreamed. And I think there are two things. One is that we have to get innovation out of, you know, these isolated little boxes and make it part of the larger programming so that the people who are innovating are sitting around the table with other folks and sharing constantly. And then we have to figure out how to export innovation or mainstream it into other programming. On livelihood, I just wanted to make this, even though it wasn't in your point, and it may be a little seem off the wall, but how many of you in here know about Kiva.org? I actually think that when we're talking about resource constraints, that's an incredible way to mobilize American dollars, citizen dollars, to help people establish and maintain livelihood in poor countries. Now, I don't have any dream that Kiva is going to develop any new market-based economies that are integrated into the global economy, and you know, countries then are on equal footing at the WTO. But I do think it's an innovative way to help some women who are struggling with feeding children and paying school fees. I know that there are some issues, you know, about how whether you're really lending to the individual or what Kiva's doing, but those kind of things that are imaginative things that are happening out and even in our broader community need to be picked up and looked at by our agencies and Congress as ways where we can mobilize American citizens and American resources to help address some of these questions that we're raising.
I can jump to Rose's question as she's asking. First of all, I think that I don't have a clear answer for you yet, but let me tell you where we're going. We agree this is something that's important when we're talking about integration of health services. What we need to do is specifically link family planning and outcomes to HIV/AIDS services. I think that Pearl Alice did a very nice job of outlining some of the political pressures which exist when the word family planning is tantamount to abortion in many places. So I think we know that family planning and preventing unintended pregnancies is a main component of PMTCT services. It's one of the four prongs of that. And I think we need to be thinking about that and how we talk more about how family planning links to that HIV/AIDS service. Again, PEPFAR dollars have to be linked to or tied to HIV/AIDS programs. The second thing that I want to note is that we also need to be looking at this in the ways we're trying to do smart integration. We don't want to duplicate with PEPFAR dollars, set up an exact same system when we have existing programs through the USAID Population Office that we can build upon or leverage. If we have an HIV/AIDS clinic and there is a country with a very strong USAID population program, how can we work with those dollars to say, we'd like you to come in, we have a nurse here who can work half-time on this, we have somebody we've trained on this, we've got a room for you in this PEPFAR-funded clinic, and then really help to pull that person in to help provide the commodities, maybe tack on to a PEPFAR-funded supply chain. There are many ways which we can look at integrating the funding, and we've been trying to do this in some of our programs already. So we're working on it. I can tell you that much, but I think we're really concerned about making sure that women do have their holistic health needs addressed.
I would just add on the results question that I think that this is the critical thing, and in fact, I think a lot of groups that are supporting development are struggling with this issue of, right now, it's not even tied to strategies. Often it's just tied to inputs. And so, you know, everyone sort of funds the training, they fund the supply of drugs, they fund the building of a health center, and then they hope somehow all of these things come together and miraculously result in, you know, the right, you know, right trained health worker in the right place at the right time with the right drugs and someone actually coming. And fund doesn't always work that smoothly. So I think part of the issue is about the indicators you choose. Oftentimes, I know, like especially in the 90s, there was a real focus on health system strengthening, and it became a bit of an end rather than a means to an end. And people had indicators around health system strengthening, and so everything was about, you know, how many workers did you train, how much did you do this and that. And it didn't link up in the end to actual results. And so I think there was an important lesson learned from that you know, health systems is critical. And you need indicators to look at interim measurement, but you have to tie it to the end result. Are you actually reaching women? Are they delivering in a facility? Are children being immunized? And then that linkage to the longer term, the outcomes, the maternal and the child mortality rates. I think there's some really interesting strategies that we want to learn from on things that are called performance-based financing or results-based financing. There's several countries that have really taken a lead in establishing these, Rwanda being one. And it's showing really impressive results that by linking a percentage of the funds that flow down to the health facilities, a percentage of those funds are now linked to the actual delivery of results. And those get verified and validated by independent means and all the rest of it. But by simply making that linkage, it's creating a level of incentives all the way down the chain to ensure that little problems that are, you know, cropping up that might otherwise have meant there were no drugs in the facility because somehow they didn't make it from the district down to the local health facility. Now that's getting corrected. because the health facility staff are saying, well, if we don't get these, we're the ones that are going to suffer. Somebody get on your bicycle and go on up there or use the bus and go up and make sure you bring this back when you visit the market. So there's suddenly this added impetus to overcome sort of the bazillions of little hurdles that get in the way of actually delivering the result. So it's something that's very interesting. Countries are extremely interested in this, and there's a lot of sharing of information going on, and USAID has been pulling together some of that learning and capturing it into some guidelines and all the rest that we want to support country teams where this is something that they see as an interesting priority. I would say, though, there is a practical reality, and so we do have to work within the practical realities of measuring what we can measure, measuring what we need to measure, and then also trying to make sure, though, that it all adds up to the end.
I just want to make one quick addition and really sound a note of optimism, because I, in response to the comments about the political issues that often accompany this work and work on women's health, that is absolutely the case, and we don't need to tell any of you in this room that. But this year actually really marks an unprecedented level of interest in the area of women and children's health. We're going to see meetings of the G8, the G20, the African Union, and, of course, this new UN joint effort on women and children's health that the Secretary General is sponsoring in the run-up to the Millennium Development Goals Summit in the fall. All of these efforts are focusing in some way on women's health. So it really is a moment of opportunity. And although it can, these issues can sometimes generate controversy, I just wanted to really say how optimistic we're feeling that these issues are getting the high level attention that they deserve, and that comprehensive healthcare for women has really been the key to all of those efforts thus far. So we're very hopeful that we can really move the ball forward in this area.
I know we had at least one more question from the back. Princeton, are you? And then let's take two more after that.
Okay. I'm Princeton Lyman, Council on Foreign Relations, and I raise this question with a little caution, because everything that's been said today is right and justified on the importance of women and children's health. But just picking up on that last comment, and comment of Pearl's about country-owned programs, when we say we have a global health initiative and it's a women and child, a women and girls-centered health initiative, and you're bringing that to the world, how do you bring that to the men of the country? How do you say this is a global health initiative, and we're looking at comprehensive health, and the men who also have HIV, TB, malaria, et cetera? And I'm just thinking of the way this program for the administration will be presented, sold, and above all, sustained over a long period of time there's a tremendous corrective here, which is absolutely right. But the question is it sustainable if it's described in the terms that we have tended to describe it today?
I think we had another question maybe right over here.
Hi, yes. This is for Amy. I've heard a lot over this last week about performance-based financing, and that's great. But I'm very concerned that we don't make the same mistakes that were made around incentivizing family planning in the past. And so what, if any, safeguards are you discussing?
And then let's take our last question up here with Julia.
I just wanted to pick up the conversation around how do we monitor and have appropriate indicators for that allow innovation and cross-sectoral work that engages factors like women's economic empowerment. So the example that was given, if a project that wasn't initially planning to do work on empowering women economically ends up doing that, how do we have the appropriate set of indicators to be able to fund those kinds of things in the future? I think it is a challenge to put all of the eggs in the outcome basket, because when we're dealing with addressing structural drivers, the changes on the actual output, say decreased HIV incidence in that population, may be 5, 10, 15 years down the line, but you will see some proximate changes along the way around women's empowerment, reductions in intimate partner violence. And then if you're looking at some of the the innovative ways of working cross-sectorally, I think we can start looking at indicators that capture that process and that reward that process. So to what extent are programs reaching out beyond the HIV field to find partners in economic development so it doesn't just depend on the chance encounter that you're starting to give money to women? To what extent are you reaching out to microfinance programs? To what extent are you looking at building bridges? Those kinds of indicators that say not necessarily that we're going to deliver that outcome in this financial year, but that we've created a scope for a broader multi-sectoral response, and rewarding that gives a possibility of that kind of innovation to happen and to continue over the years. And then over time, we'll start to build the evidence base of how that links to the HIV outcomes. But I think to expect it all to happen within a program time frame might be a bit difficult. So I think there are indicators that are out there already, probably within USAID's own development portfolio, that may not be as familiar to the PEPFAR or HIV folks on how do you build those intersectoral linkages and what measures progress in terms of women's economic participation and empowerment.
Why don't we start with that last question, Perlaus?
I'm going to start with Princeton's question.
Okay, let's start with Princeton's question then.
I'll start with Princeton's question and comment. Princeton, I'm glad you raised that because I think there is a danger in us sort of conflating women-centered, the concept of women-centered, with then that all things health are women's health. And it doesn't mean that. But I remember when I was studying for my master's in public health that we were told that there was a single indicator that you could look at and really determine a lot about a society, and that was infant mortality rate. And it didn't mean that everything you did had to be only about infants, but it did mean that everything you had to do, that single indicator and reducing infant mortality would tell you how successful your programs were. And I think if you look at a women-centered approach to healthcare, what we're saying, and what I think we should help men understand, that we're not talking about women's health exclusive to their health, but that if you look at the health of women in your country, it will tell you a lot about the development and other things about your country, and that you focus on women's health kind of as an indicator of how you target program, initiative, and effort to lift a country out of poverty. We definitely have to focus on the health of populations in general. And thank you for reminding us that we should be mindful of making a mistake of by not raising that we can mislead people into thinking that we're not talking about, one, health for the whole community, including men, but two, educating men about why women's health is so important.
I'm just going to jump onto that with a slightly flip answer, but I do appreciate bringing it up. I don't know if you asked this question of Ambassador Goosby this morning, because I could tell you what he says as both a doctor and a man about this issue. Men go to doctors when they're sick. Women go to doctors for preventive medicine, and women bring their children to doctors for preventive medicine. So if we focus, and I'm doing this in a very blatant appeal to men, if we focus on building a woman and girl-centered health system, by the time that man gets to see a doctor because he's sick, that woman will have been there three times, once for herself, two times with the kids. The doctors will have been trained. The clinic will have been staffed. She's doing the test runs. And by the time the guy gets there, it's all set. It's all operating. So that's why you should be doing a woman and girl-centered focus, because your quality of care is going to be better. But I do think it's an important point, and I would note that this administration, you have a Secretary of State and a Secretary of Health and Human Services, in addition to a president and a USAID administrator and a global AIDS coordinator, who are all going out with this message, both women and men, at a variety of levels, engaging with ministries of foreign affairs, ministries of gender, ministries of education, ministries of development. All of us are saying it's a woman and girl-centered approach, and this is something which is not only going to benefit women, it's going to benefit communities, it's going to benefit economies, and it's going to benefit your countries.
On the question about performance-based financing, I think you raised an excellent point about the importance of how you structure it and what indicators you're measuring and all the rest to ensure that you're not setting up perverse incentives. And in fact, for something that absolutely must be protected as sort of a voluntary issue of family planning, it's extremely important how you might structure something like performance-based financing. And in fact, USAID has sort of taken it completely as a separate topic
from sort of when we talk about performance-based financing and how it might be used for many health interventions, many cautionary notes about, you know, whether this should even be applied at all to family planning, or if a country feels it needs to be applied to family planning, you know, sort of very cautionary guidance about how to think very carefully about that, how to structure it to ensure it maintains sort of a voluntary issue and all the rest. So I think it's an extremely important point, but it's not only for family planning. If you choose the wrong indicator and you're structuring a performance-based financing mechanism on it, you can cause a lot of harm as well. And so it's there's a great deal of potential with this strategy, but it's one that has to be sort of very carefully thought through, very carefully monitored for any application in any country program. In terms of this issue of the kind of cross-sectoral indicators, I think that that's a really important point. And sometimes trying to structure indicators so there is that crossover between sectors can be the most valuable way forward. And I know we've been thinking about it in nutrition, for example, of how do we get the agricultural group who are looking more at kind of quantity of food to use stunting as an indicator, for example, and how do we get the health people to use something like access to an affordable basket of dairy products or some such thing, so that we're really looking at kind of the dietary needs. And sort of getting that crossover indicator can then drive the kind of behaviors of both sectoral groups. So it's an extremely kind of important and creative point for us to pull out. And I think there are a lot of indicators that have been identified. The goal now, I think, is to put all the different indicators that groups have been working on the table, sort of determine which are the best ones that we want to stick with, because we don't want too many. Otherwise, they really, you know, sort of that real value can get lost. And see about trying to get a harmonized approach to adopting some of those indicators, or identify where there are real gaps, where the indicators are not going as far as they need to go, and where people might want to start thinking creatively about tweaking them.
Just one final note on the focus on women and girls. First, I have to say that with advocates and leaders like Ambassador Goosby and Administrator Shah and our secretary and, of course, our president, all putting women and girls at the center of what they do, it really makes the job of Ambassador Verveer and elevating the issues of women and girls quite lovely. So we really appreciate the great partners we have and the work that we're doing. But I just wanted to make the note that although we are talking today about the Global Health Initiative and the centrality of women and girls in that program, that really the centrality of women and girls to our entire development program is something that's really characterized this administration's approach for the same reasons that investing in women and girls really has this multiplier effect, and study after study demonstrates that. So not to exclude at all the effects that our development programs have in the focus on men and boys as well, but that having this particular focus really has such an important impact. And that is also a message that the Secretary is carrying forth as we approach the Millennium Development Goal Summit in the fall, that as Anne recognized earlier, of course, all of the health-related MDGs are interrelated, but really that MDG 3, that gender equality, is really the key to achieving not just the health-related MDGs, but all of the MDGs, and that is a particular focus, not just of the Secretary, but of the entire administration.
Any other closing thoughts from our panelists? No? Please join me in thanking this really wonderful group for coming and sharing their insights. So I think we're just going to take a 30-second break to have our panel exit, and then I think Janet has some closing summary remarks that she wants to provide. So. I'm not going to take too much of your time now because we're a little bit over time. I just want to take a minute, first of all, to thank you all for your excellent participation in today's proceedings. I think we could go on for another 2 days on this because I know we all have about 1,000 more questions for this panel and for all the others. So I want to, first of all, thank all the panelists because I think we had some really thoughtful and remarkable presentations today. All the PowerPoints will be available on the website, the CSIS. Is someone around to help me? Is it going to be the CSIS.org or the SmartGlobalHealth.org website, one or the others? We'll let you know, or if you can't find it, let me know. So all the PowerPoints will be available. I had assured our panelists that if they had to speed up, that you would get a chance to look at some of those slides that they went over a little too quickly. So thank you also for all the hard work you put into preparing all these slides. Again, for those of you who traveled from so far, we are really grateful that you could come. And I think this is a remarkable moment of, as Julia was just saying, this convergence of factors right now, this moment of clearly U.S. policy interest and program experience that they can draw from, a whole engaged policy community that is eager to push this agenda forward. We are really at a historic juncture, and I think we all have to work together. We have to move forward and do our best to make sure that this window of opportunity does not close and that we begin to really get some traction on these important issues for the lives of the women and girls that we are hoping to affect. So thank you all very much, and we will stay in touch on all these issues.